Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. As well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Elections and democracy is our topic on this week's show. $4 billion. That's how much was spent throughout the United States on yesterday's election, the most expensive midterm election in American history. A new book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, by John Nichols and Robert McChesney, looks at the phenomenon of money in politics today. Quoting from the introduction, the authors write, "The type of society we have is far better understood as a dollarocracy than as a democracy. We have a system that is now defined more by $1 one vote than by one person one vote. We live in a society where a small number of fabulously wealthy individuals and giant corporations control most of the dollars and, by extension, have most of the political power. They buy election results that give them control over the government, and they hire lobbyists to fine-tune that control so that the distribution of wealth and income continually skews to their advantage." Here to talk about dollarocracy is one of the co-authors, Robert McChesney. He's a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the author or editor of 23 books. Robert McChesney, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
It's my pleasure to be here, David.
So let's talk about the election that has just barely finished. And here in Vermont, it's not even quite finished. We have a gubernatorial race where the outcome has the Republican contender has not yet conceded. So technically, this is still open. What do you look at the current election? What has been the impact of money on this election?
Well, money defines our election races now. They are the be-all and end-all of campaigns. This is not even a debated point. Most politicians are running for office spending hours per day fundraising, right?
Bob, let me just interrupt you. The sound is maybe you could hold the phone a little close to your mouth, or if it's on any sort of speakerphone, turn that off. But it
okay. Is this better?
Not much.
How's this?
That's a little better. So,
is this even better?
Oh, that's perfect, whatever you just did there.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, as I was saying, money is the be-all, end-all of American politics. I mean, it's difficult to put quite in context. This is what I mean, for Americans to understand this. For example, in the German national elections last year, for every dollar Germany spent on its campaign for its parliament and chancellor's position, we spent in 2012 $35. We outspend every other democracy by a factor of at least 10 to 1 in our campaigns, both mid-year and general elections, presidential elections. And, you know, this money comes from a very small number, relatively speaking, of people with distinct agendas. For the people who make these huge donations, it's not that they love this country that much more than anyone else. These are really investments, oftentimes, to produce results that will favor their business interests. And you get a politics then that you would expect in an environment where that is the way politics is exercised.
So who was the big winner in yesterday's election, in your view? Who or what?
Well, I don't know if there's a big winner. I mean, what's striking about yesterday's election, the issue that no one really talks about seriously, it is the overwhelming, screaming fact of yesterday's election. That's what it was in 2010, is this. I watched MSNBC last night, and Chris Matthews intoned that there's a huge Republican wave in the country. Nothing of the kind could be true. The fact of the matter is, the difference between 2012 and 2014 is the fact that all sorts of people who went to the polls as Democrats in 2012 said, gee, we tried the Democrats, now let's go Republican in 2014. That happened. Maybe some people
potentially
changed their mind.
Bob, I got to cut in here because the sound quality is we're really having a hard time understanding you. So whatever you did the first time to make it clearer, do it again.
Okay, is this working again, David?
Yes, that is better.
Okay, well, the point basically is that what has happened between 2012 and 2014 is that Democrats stopped voting. It's not that Democrats changed their mind. We have the lowest voter turnout rate in the world of democratic nations. No other country comes close to us. If some country like Venezuela had a 35 or 40% voter turnout rate, U.S. government would declare it a sham democracy. Well, that's what we had yesterday. Depending on the state you're in, and I haven't seen the final totals, but it's probably in the range of 30 to 40% of the people over 18 actually engaged in voting yesterday. And, you know, it was mostly what happens is in our presidential year, like 2012 and 2014, is that we have a situation where Democrats stop voting, young people stop voting, people of color stop voting, poor people stop voting, and Republicans keep voting. So yesterday, David, 37% of our voters in the early data I've seen, 37% are senior citizens. I mean, that accounts for an enormous amount of our voting base.
So, and I know, putting it in the Vermont context, yesterday's election was the lowest voter turnout since 1978. Why is this happening? Why is voter turnout falling further and further each time?
I think that I'm one who's always quite critical of how low the voter turnout is in the United States. I write about it a lot. I'm disappointed that our political analysts don't like to talk about it because it's sort of like admitting that our system really isn't working at all when you acknowledge that most people don't participate in it. And then that sort of ruins the whole pundit game. If you have nothing you're punditing about something, it really isn't democracy. Why is that? Well, I think there's two or three really important reasons. Number one, most races are gerrymandered so the outcome is known before you go into it. How many people will go watch a football game if you absolutely knew the outcome ahead of time? A basketball game. The attendance can get some people, but not many. Well, in most election races on my ballot, when I go to vote, the outcome is given. I know my member of Congress will win. It's been gerrymandered, so a Democrat will always win that seat. And I know that in those only races that are really competitive tend to be statewide races where you can't do gerrymandering, but then money comes into play. Or in most states, you might live in a state where there's really no competition between the parties, so there's really uncontested races or only loosely contested races. So it's hard to convince people that voting is that important when most of the races are, really determined before the polls even open. In addition, I think what's happened to me, and I think a lot of voters, and I suspect a lot of your listeners, is that the amount of money that's going into politics is so great that I used to give money to candidates, $50 or $100 here and there to help out. I've stopped doing that with only a handful of exceptions of politicians I really believe in. And the reason is that I know that almost all the money I give a politician now is going to end up going to a commercial broadcaster to pay for stupid advertising that's an insult to my intelligence, even for candidates I support. And I'm saying, why should I give my hard-earned money for that when they can go out and get billionaires to give them money to pay for these stupid ads? It simply goes to pay commercial broadcasting companies.
Well, and now we know that in the current election, 55% of broadcast ads in this midterms were bought by groups that don't reveal their donors. How is this different from the past? And maybe it'd be helpful to get you to explain the difference between dark money and super PACs.
Yeah, well, this is the crucial thing I think listeners need to understand. Throughout American history, until very recently, the American people, through their elected representatives, at almost every turn, have been obsessed with having fair elections. They wanted to have elections where someone couldn't completely outspend their opponent and buy an election. The dream, of course, was to have small contributions where there's a limit on it, pay for campaigns, so that when you went into the ballot booth and cast your vote, it wasn't like someone could spend 1,000 times more than someone else. The other key factor that people insisted upon is you ought to know who's giving money to candidates so no one can secretly buy a candidate unbeknownst to the voters. So those are the two themes that I think have been almost universally accepted by all elected bodies, by all voters in America, whatever the issue's been raised. There have been literally hundreds of governments, the government bodies that have weighed in on this issue. Now, what's happened in America, the Great Revolution in the last 40 years, is starting in the 1970s, there was concerted movement by elements of the business community and of very wealthy individuals to say, hey, this is no fun if we can't buy elections. We want to have unlimited spending by corporations, by individuals on election campaigns. We think that's our First Amendment right. And it really took 3.5 decades before they could finally get 5 members of the Supreme Court to sign off on that radical idea. And that did happen with the Roberts Court in 2010 and the now infamous Citizens United decision. Now, in fairness to the Citizens United decision, which basically said you could have unlimited government, individual and corporate spending on campaigns, they also said you could have unlimited labor union spending. And some of your older listeners might remember what labor unions are. They were these things we had back in the middle of the 20th century. And, you know, but what's happened is that even the Supreme Court in 2010 said that voters still have a right to know who's giving this money to campaigns, or what even voters have a right to know who's giving money to independent third-party groups that support candidates. That this is imperative so you can prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. But regrettably, there's almost no way to enforce this, and the Supreme Court has shown no concern about the fact that we've seen this massive growth in what's called dark money, which are contributions to groups that do not have to report their donors through loopholes in the law because they're not formally associated with campaigns and they're not formally commissioned just to run campaign ads. And so logically, if you're rich and you want to influence a campaign, you don't want your identity known, you aren't going to try to give money where you have to publicize it. You're going to seek out groups where you can legally get away with not having your identity known. And that's where all the smart money is going. That's where all the money is going. That's who's paying for our elections now.
So you talk about In Dollarocracy, your new book, and I should say we're talking with Robert McChesney, the author of the book Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. You can join the conversation by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. You talk about pay-to-play elections. Give me an example that stands out in your mind where money bought politicians and politics.
Well, you know, I think there are examples, and we give them in the book, in previous years of where, you know, large money interests simply go in and buy up an election. And I think that I can give you several of those if you'd like. But I do think if we look at it that way, we're missing the really most important part of the picture, David, which is that it's not just specific instances of a wealthy person or firm buying the outcome of an election that matters. It's more the broader culture in which to be a successful politician, you've got to participate in this or you can't buy the barrage of ads that are now seen as necessary to win an election. And so everyone, whether you like it or not, even a principled politician, if they're those that are left, is really faced with this almost Sophie's choice about their career if they want to be successful and stay in office. And that's the crime here. The crime here is that it doesn't create space to make it possible to be a principled opponent of Dollarocracy if you want to succeed. But having said that, some of the examples we give in the book, the most egregious immediate examples where you actually have business going in and buying elections have been in judicial races. And the court system in the United States, and I think 39 of our 50 states elect their state Supreme Courts. Starting about 20 years ago, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce decided that this was really the place to go to get business in the driver's seat of America. If they could take over the state Supreme Courts, they could pretty much end the fear of having civil suits against business malpractice, the tort suits, because they could use the Supreme Court to get those thrown out or the fines reduced. And they started increasing the spending to these races dramatically. Probably the most egregious example of this, where we actually have one company, is that back about 10 years ago in West Virginia, a large mining company lost a civil case after it killed scores of miners in one of its mines due to faulty management. And the company appealed to the state Supreme Court. And the time it went up to the appeal, the company spent millions of dollars on the election to the Supreme Court and got a majority elected to the Supreme Court. So by the time it got to them, it ruled in the company's favor. I mean, just a blatant case of buying judges and getting saving themselves tens or hundreds of millions of dollars as a result.
Well, in a current example that's been followed in the media has been the case in Richmond, California, home to a huge Chevron refinery, where Chevron spent some $3 million, I believe it was, to defeat some anti-Chevron or let's just say not sufficiently pro-Chevron city council members and mayor. But in that case, Chevron has apparently lost, and the slate of progressive candidates and the mayor, who have been very critical of Chevron, managed to hold on to their seats. So I wonder what the dynamic is that can effectively challenge the dollarocracy that you write about.
Well, that's exciting to hear. And, you know, I think it doesn't mean you automatically win, especially when you have a coherent opposition. It raises two points, the Chevron instance you mentioned. First of all, you know, you gave the figure at the top of the show, David, of I think almost $4 billion being the price tag of the midterm elections. That figure, I believe, is only for congressional races. It's not. I don't think it refers to statewide gubernatorial races, state elections, and local elections. And that's where a lot of the most corrupting money goes, is to these local races, where in many cases, individuals in a city no longer have much news coverage, so they don't really have much information about candidates and issues in their news media, because there's so little news media left that covers elections beyond some trivia. And as a result of that, companies have found they can go in and gobble up city council members or some other local positions relatively easily without too much opposition, Richmond notwithstanding. So, the crisis extends all the way to the bottom of the ballot ticket. I mean, even the smallest jobs in cities where there's moneyed interest, but the interest in the outcome are in play. And dollarocracy goes from the top of the ballot to the very bottom. Is it insurmountable? Is it undefeatable? No. I think it obviously they're spending all this money because they fear they might lose. They're spending this money because they think they need to get the policies they want to be successful. That means that there's a chance that they can lose. And I think for those who are concerned about American politics and the health of our governance, it's how do you defeat this is really the central issue that we face right now.
Your subtitle of Dollarocracy is how the money and media election complex is destroying America. What do you mean by media election complex?
Well, the key part of the story, which I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's almost never mentioned in the news media accounts of money in politics, is that simultaneously with the rise of money in politics, what we have is this decline of journalism, of campaign journalism, that's just shrinking up and disappearing, so that people are increasingly without resources to really participate knowledgeably in politics. There are much fewer than they used to be. There's just not that many people covering politics who are accountable for what they do. And what has happened with this huge influx of money into politics, most of which goes to pay for television, political advertising, and now internet advertising, this becomes lingua franca. People basically learn about politics from TV ads or other ads, oftentimes negative ads. And in a democratic society, theoretically, and certainly to the framers of the Republic of the United States, the people who wrote our Constitution, the idea was that there would be a fourth estate of media, of journalists, who would be a central part of the political process and draw people into political life. That institution is pretty much dead in the United States today. So any effort to get money out of politics has to come up with a way to increase the information about politics, the journalism about politics, if our system's going to really thrive.
Well, we have a good example of that here in Vermont. The largest statewide paper, the Burlington Free Press, just announced that it was firing its only two political reporters. And this just happened on the eve of the election. I saw them covering the election yesterday. It was their last day on the job. These are 20-plus-year veteran reporters. And the reason given is that Gannett, which owns the newspaper, is redeploying journalists from beats to cover, it's unclear what they're covering, but basically political stories don't get that many clicks compared to crime, sports, and the kind of PR that passes as journalism. And so In a small state with a small cadre of political reporters, it has just grown considerably smaller here.
That's the case nationwide. It's not just Vermont. It's not just small states. It's states with large populations like Illinois, where I teach and where I am very active. And I can tell you that it is a crisis that's not going to go away. It's not going to get any better. The problem is based on a very core economic issue, which is the basis for journalism, commercial journalism, for the last 125 years in the United States, has been advertising. Advertising has provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues that supported news media, be they newspapers, news magazines, radio, or television. Well, in the internet era, advertising has fled the support of journalism. It can go online now and accomplish far more effectively its commercial aims without having to bankroll or subsidize news media, even news media websites. And this is leaving traditional news media, all news media, including internet news media, in the lurch. They simply don't have much resources. And so they're cutting back their staff right and left everywhere. And we're paying, and I don't think America has quite come to grips with what it means not to have a news media, not to have a political journalism. And the political journalism we're left with, which was never very good to begin with, but increasingly it's just gossiping, salacious stuff about, you know, whether someone's inane political advertising is working, but very little concrete political journalism that gets into what the governing process, how it's going to be affected by candidates, what the issues are, what the issues candidates don't want to talk about, rather than just the ones they do want to talk about. We're losing that altogether, so that it's very hard for citizens to really wrap themselves around political campaigns in the way that might have been possible two or three generations ago.
We're talking with Robert McChesney, the co-author of the new book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Bob, this very notion of bought-off elections and dollarocracy is part of what is driving voter turnout to these record lows that we're seeing both in Vermont and around the country. What do you see as the most promising counterattack that would push back or challenge the kind of phenomenon that you're talking about, where politicians, politics, and the media are bought and paid for?
Well, I think the best answer I can give you goes back to 1984. If you remember back then, David, Ronald Reagan was running for re-election, and he had come into a very bad economy, and by 1984, in his re-election, the economy was really cooking. And it looked like he was going to be very difficult to beat in the general election that year. And the Democratic nominee was Walter Mondale. And Walter Mondale realized about in the summer of 1984 that he didn't really have much of a chance of winning the election. It was pretty obvious the polls were against him, and history said it's hopeless. So he commissioned a couple of people to do an exam. They say, is there any way on earth I can win this election in 1984? What would I have to do? And they commissioned some people who did a 200-page report. And the report said basically the only way you can win this election, Walter Mondale, you have to expand the voting turnout rate from 50%, which it probably will be, to 60%. And if you can get union households, poor people, people of color, young people to vote, you actually can win this election. If there was a 60% voter turnout rate, you probably would win the election. But it's going to be 50% and you will lose in a landslide. So you need to come up with a way to get 10% more of the population to vote. And they actually gave him recommendations. Walter Mondale, this is what you need to do to get people to vote for you. You've got to give them something, a dramatic sense that if you're elected, people change their lives appreciably, like dramatically raising the minimum wage, a series of policy proposals that really get people captivated, people on the margins who don't normally participate. And the Democratic Party studied this, and they basically said, no, we don't want to do that. We would rather lose with the existing electorate and try to expand the electorate because we think it, and this is where I'm interpreting it, because we think it would antagonize the money of interest who are paying for our campaigns currently. They really weren't interested in expanding the electorate. It's clear to me that that report was accurate. Mm-hmm. If you really want to get Americans to vote at higher numbers, we have to give them reasons to vote. We have to give them a sense that there's something really important to see that can improve their lives. They're not always voting for the lesser of two evils. There's actually a chance for governments to effectively solve problems and do it well.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Robert McChesney, thanks for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
My great pleasure, David. Good luck with the show.
Okay, Robert McChesney is the co-author of Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We'll be back after the news.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. President Obama and fellow Democrats face the next 2 years with Republicans in firm control of Congress. GOP Party Chairman Reince Priebus says the party's victories cross political dividing lines.
We won in red states, we won in blue states, and we won in purple states. We won because our policies resonated with the electorate, our ground game mobilized voters, and our candidates connected with the American people.
Secretary of State John Kerry, who is on a visit to Paris, tells reporters even though the Republicans have the majority in the Senate, Democrats will have a lot to say.
While it may be Republican or Democrat, it's still subject to 60 votes. And as we have learned in the last few years, the minority has enormous power to stop things from happening.
President Obama will talk about the election losses when he meets with reporters later this afternoon. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're continuing our coverage of elections and democracy. Our guest in the second half hour is Zephyr Teachout, a professor at Fordham Law School who recently ran for governor of New York against Andrew Cuomo. Despite the fact that Governor Cuomo had a $30 million war chest, Teachout, who was a newcomer to electoral politics, took more than a third of the vote in the Democratic primary and forced Cuomo to campaign furiously against her, at one point trying to block her candidacy in the courts. Zephyr Teachout grew up in Norwich, attended Yale and Duke Law School, and then came home to Vermont to help transform Howard Dean's presidential campaign from unknown to frontrunner, for a time at least. She's the daughter of Mary Miles Teachout, a state court judge, and Peter Teachout, a professor at Vermont Law School. Zephyr Teachout, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Sure. Well, we should start here in Vermont, and what led you to decide to head out from Vermont and venture into New York politics and run for governor there?
You make it sound like I was sitting in Vermont and sort of casting my sights over the border, but
who grows up here.
I actually had, right before I moved to New York, I'd been living in North Carolina. I had a fellowship there. I've lived in North Carolina on and off several years. I had a fellowship there as a young academic, and honestly, I was looking for long-term tenure-track jobs, and I got one in New York City at Fordham Law School. I was thrilled to come to New York City, but that was a little over 5 years ago. And then once I came to New York, you know, ironically, I had thought it was such a big state, it would be hard to get involved in politics. So did I know that I would become very involved. But I've loved politics for a long time, and And so when I moved to New York, I connected pretty quickly with some folks at a thing called the Working Families Party, which is a party that plays within Democratic politics in New York State, and then also have been very involved in banking reform. I worked as a grassroots lobbyist on the bill that ended up being Dodd-Frank. So I've been pretty involved in politics one way or another. And then last March, some people approached me about running against Andrew Cuomo.
So let me just ask you, the sound quality on your phone there is, it's kind of coming in and out. So I guess if you can hold the phone a little closer to your mouth.
Is that better?
Yes, that's a little better. Now, Andrew Cuomo, this was going to be a very heavy lift. This is a guy with a very powerful political machine. Why take him on with the low likelihood that you would be able to defeat him?
Well, the biggest reason is that I disagreed with his policies, and I thought I would do a better job than he would. I mean, it's a pretty old-fashioned idea, but you run for office because you think you'll do a better job than the other guy. But you talk about probabilities, and I actually think, when we were looking at it, I thought maybe I had a 1 in 20 chance of beating Andrew Cuomo. I think that's high. I think too often people enter politics looking for a sure thing, and if you're looking for a sure thing in politics, you're probably looking in the wrong place. So 1 in 20 chance of beating him, and certainly a decent chance of actually at least making a dent. I think we did make a dent. I mean, yesterday he was reelected as governor, but as a much weaker governor, and I hope it empowers other populist Democrats like myself to take him on in the state house.
Zephyr, I think what we're going to do is call you right back on this thing. I think on this the number that you're on, so I'm going to...
I'm sorry that that's not working out. It usually works out, but I'll hang up.
Yeah, why don't you hang up, and we'll call you right back. But meanwhile, I'm going to read from a piece that Zephyr Teachout has in yesterday's Guardian, in which she writes about, the piece is called Whatever Happened to Of the People, By the People, For the People, A Manifesto. And the subhead is The Super Rich Have Just Bought Another Election. They Own American Democracy. Here's How to Take the Power Back. She writes that one early morning in Brooklyn a few months ago, when I was still running for governor of New York, I encountered a man talking to himself, agitated and loud. As I passed him on the sidewalk, he turned to me and started muttering, a blend of insults and epigrams. And then, just as I was about to vanish down the stairs into the subway, he yelled with a full throat, I am the captain of my ship. I am the master of my soul. I was shaken and not a little moved. This man is all of us, protesting that we still have control over ourselves, despite the obvious evidence otherwise. Because I was on the way to a political event, I felt it more broadly. We, America, we are that man, yelling about our own self-government, broadcasting these elections, trying in bluster to defy this simple, terrifying truth. We are not governed by ourselves. We have given up control of the ship. And on that note, we'll go back to the real live Zephyr Teachout. Zephyr, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, that sounds much better.
Oh, good.
Well, we had your words coming through anyway. I was reading your op-ed piece in yesterday's Guardian.
What I was trying to talk about is, I'm a historian as well, and I actually just completed a book on the history of corruption in American law. And in real terms, I actually think one of the most important things in politics is just to tell the truth about what's happening. And what I see is that really since the early 90s and then accelerated since 2010 in Citizens United, big money has really taken over politics in a significant way. That may be less true in a place like Vermont, but it's certainly very true in New York State, and it's very true in the country.
And what do you see? Well, what was your experience in New York with big money coming in?
Well, I had, it was a very unusual race. And like you said, we ended up getting about 35%, a little under 35%. In order to get there, I needed media attention. And usually the way to get media attention is by raising enough money that the media pays attention to you. So there's a kind of circular quality, actually. Like, if I have $20,000, even if I have good ideas and good management experience, it's hard to get any press to pay attention to you. I had the advantage of running against Andrew Cuomo, who doesn't like competition, and so he actually sued me to get me off the ballot. And in that lawsuit, we got the kind of media attention that usually you need to raise money to get, and started becoming a real presence in the media. Because they were sort of confused and excited about the fact that there was a lawsuit instead of a debate during the election. But I also will tell you, you know, I took my job seriously as a fundraiser. It's, if that's the job of politics, I'll do that. So I spent about half my time for the first 6 weeks fundraising. What that means in practical terms is you sit in a room with your fundraiser. You have a list of names. You have 15 minutes to talk to each person max. You have a number next to those names. And you become basically like a call center. That's sort of the job of politics nowadays, is to be at a call center calling through, trying to raise money. No, I would think of it sometimes as similar to you know, being a vacuum cleaner salesman. It's about the same amount of money you're trying to raise from each person. You have the ask, you have the silence while you wait to see where they come through. And I've written about this a lot, but the experience, I can see how profoundly, first of all, it's somewhat humiliating, demeaning to be sort of constantly begging several hours a day. And we've built this political system where we're choosing people who are good at begging for money. It's a very weird way to choose leaders. But also that it changes the way you talk about things. And I was very aware of this, so I hope it didn't change the way I talk about things. But I was raising a lot of money from tech folks. High-tech mm-hmm. folks mm-hmm. who may not bring a very positive view of teachers' unions. I have a very positive associations with teachers' union, but there's some problems, but I think they're actually centrally important in supporting and protecting our schools and our kids. And call after call, if you're talking to people and they say, well, I like what you're doing, but where do you stand on schools? It becomes pretty clear that you're going to be able to raise more money if you throw teachers' unions under the bus. And I just did this for 6 weeks. You know, imagine if you're doing this, as most Congress people do, for 5 years, spending half of their time talking to people who have, you know, a pretty strong political slant away from public investments.
So how much did you raise doing half-time, being a half-time fundraiser for 6 weeks?
We raised $880,000, I believe, in my 3.5 months running. And that was from 9,000 donors. So what happened is, once we caught fire, I didn't actually have to spend as much time fundraising, and I chose to spend more time talking to the press directly. We started getting lots and lots of small donors. Our average donation was $57. And I'm proud of that, but I also think you can't rely on every campaign having that kind of media attention that we had. It's not a system. It's like, it's a lightning struck. It was great. I think it's far more likely to strike in races like mine, where people are raising core issues about economic inequality and populism that aren't heard enough. But I can't say that my race is a promise that all populists are going to be able to raise money without having to compromise themselves.
How do you get rich people to be excited about poor people and economic inequality?
Well, some people are. You know, I'm actually looking at a history right now of campaign funding systems, and what you see is that the Democrats over time have had far fewer big dollar supporters, and that number is really quite marked. The difference between the Republicans and Democrats is really marked through the early 90s. You'll see lots and lots of big money donors giving to Republicans and far fewer to Democrats. It starts changing after Clinton. You see a lot more big money donors to Democrats, and I think it's changed the politics on the Democratic side as well. But even back in the 1907, 1915, you see a handful of truly populist, progressive, very wealthy Democrats who give money. The way that I would appeal to the super wealthy, and I can't say I had great success with the super wealthy. My biggest donations were $20,000, which I know sounds a lot for Vermont, but in New York, the real limits are around $120,000 you can raise from a couple. Ones are extraordinarily high. Most of my donations were much smaller. But the folks I would reach out to, I would basically talk to about, well, let me think about it. For my biggest number donations, the 10 or 20,000, I was talking about how the breakdown of democracy was leading to the breakdown of a competitive marketplace. Because we have just a handful of monopolies that are really taking over our economy. That's big banks, big gas and oil, big ag. and all of those actually limit the entrepreneurial spirit. And so I would reach out to entrepreneurs and talk about how we really need to, very much like Teddy Roosevelt and FDR, break up these big companies. And that was a central part of my campaign.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation this week to Zephyr Teachout. She is a professor at the Fordham Law School, a Vermonter who has, since her time in Vermont, moved to, now lives in New York, and ran against Governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary for governor, winning over a third of the vote. You tell us about the role that you played in Governor Howard Dean's presidential campaign and what you learned from that.
I had been at that time I was also moving from North Carolina. I was a death penalty lawyer in North Carolina. And, I heard that, Governor Dean was going to run for president. So I moved to Vermont, volunteered for the campaign as a researcher. Are you still there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. Yeah, great. And I ended up, being the director of online organizing for Howard Dean's campaign. First, I was responsible for 18 states and then for the country in figuring out new tools to use to organize online. So at the time, that was meetup.com. We had an extensive use of the tool Meetup. We used hundreds and hundreds of Yahoo groups, which your listeners may remember as being sort of a central form of organizing. Mm-hmm. And then we also built tools. So I hired the first programmers for a presidential campaign. Now that's pretty normal, but in 2002, 2003, that was not normal, to actually build new tools to allow people to connect with each other and organize with each other and do phone banking from home. That was one of our big new tools. So it was a really transformational campaign for me in a lot of ways. I mean, there's so many things I learned. Certainly one is that a lot of campaigns talk about giving people power, but relatively few actually do. And if you are willing to trust people, and you know, we did it through technology on Howard Dean's campaign, but technology isn't actually the key ingredient. The key ingredient, I think, is trust. That people will do so much more work, bring so much more creativity, bring so much more talent, strategy, if you actually trust them to organize locally and trust that if you have a deep political alignment, you're going to be on the same side. Most campaigns tend to be really, really controlled. And I think they leave a lot of power on the table that way. So that was one key lesson. Some other things I learned had nothing to do with the internet. They had more to do with, and they were essential political lessons for me, lessons without which I would not have been able to do what I did in running against Andrew Cuomo. One is to not only accept, but actually welcome a fight. That if you're an underdog, the best thing that can happen is that the front runner can punch down, as they say. You know, they say never punch down. And so if there's an opportunity where somebody's front runner and they're punching out or lashing out at you, that may be your most important and exciting moment. So most of my campaign staff was on board with this, but I had to persuade a few that the best thing that could happen to me was Andrew Cuomo attacking, trying to get me kicked off the ballot, bringing a lawsuit. So we invited, when Andrew Cuomo tried to kick me off the ballot, claiming that I lived in Vermont. I always joked, you know, you could just go back up to a general store in my hometown, Dan and Witt's, Norwich, and ask people, and they'd tell you I haven't lived there for a while. But he was claiming that I still lived in Vermont. And so we invited all the press to come to the trial, and they came and they loved it. I think before Howard Dean's campaign, I might have had a more, you know, what you might say, intuitive response is, well, if they're criticizing you, if they're hitting you, you got to hide that, you got to avoid the conflict. But I really learned from Governor Dean and from his sort of chief strategists the ways to take those moments of conflict and actually make them about what you want them to be about. So this trial was a trial about whether or not I had a car registered in Vermont. I keep my parents' barn. Whether that's evidence that I wasn't a New Yorker. Well, it became a great opportunity to talk about, you know, what real New Yorkers live through. I'm not particularly wealthy, so I rented instead of owned. You know, he was challenging me for not having copies of all my old leases, and I could use that as an opportunity to talk about the rent being too high in New York and the core issues of economic inequality in New York. So you can take these conflict moments and really turn them into moments where you talk about real ideas, and I learned that from Dean's campaign.
Let's talk about what has happened in the last 24 hours in the country where Republicans have made major inroads in numerous statewide races. The Senate has flipped now back to Republican control. You tweeted today, Democrats can win in the future, but with a clear, populist, powerful ideas, challenging big banks and debt, telling the truth. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's always fun to try to decipher tweets. But what I mean is that I'll just step back for a second. I see what happened yesterday as the end of a 30-year cycle that really starts with Bill Clinton, with a kind of what you might call centrist, although I object to the language because I actually think I'm pretty centrist, traditional Democrat, a pro-corporate trickle-down philosophy that's sort of gradually taken over the Democratic Party, and it's defended on the grounds that it's more centrist and that's where people are. I think what we saw yesterday is that Democratic ideology fails. It doesn't work. It doesn't get people out of bed. It doesn't get them to vote. People don't believe it. They don't trust it. And instead, if we want to win, we have to actually abandon that DLC Clintonism and actually go back to our traditional roots, which is FDR. Really look at the Democrats of the 50s, 60s, 70s, where we had a much stronger commitment to union power, a much stronger commitment to the public sphere. We have to fight back against the privatization of public education and really recommit to public education and do it in this fearless, open way where we're not apologizing for believing that we deserve and can have an equal economy. So I think that what we saw yesterday is that's the end. That channel isn't working. Now, that doesn't mean people are not going to keep going down that channel because it's a lot easier to raise money if you're a Clintonite Democrat. But we have an opportunity, I think. Now, there's another energy in this country, which is to actually reclaim a small business economy, reclaim public education, and be proud and fearless about it.
We're talking with Zephyr Teachout, a professor at Fordham Law School who ran against Andrew Cuomo in the New York State primary. She's the author of a new book, Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizen United. Just getting back to the election yesterday, one of the curious things that went on is while we had a number of very conservative senators elected, we also had a number of sort of progressive, if you want to call it, or I don't know what to call it, referenda on things like marijuana legalization or medical marijuana legalization, things like that, passing in the same states where very conservative senators were being elected. How do you reconcile those two things?
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I want to go back to what I was saying before. Is that, first of all, on marijuana legalization, the country has tipped. It's moved in that direction, and that's a very good thing, I believe. That I think a lot of politicians are really far behind on where people are on marijuana. You know, I can tell you in New York State, you'll see politicians where you can't actually explain it by big money. I think it's just they came up in politics in the 80s and 90s and scared of drugs and scared of, you know, all the associations they may have with that. But the vast majority of the state wants legalization, decriminalization of marijuana, and yet politicians won't move there. So the referendum are stepping into that gap. I don't think that 1990s division between Republicans and Democrats still holds, and I think that right now Democrats. I mean, I'll just repeat myself. I think Democrats need to put a stake in the ground and have a clear vision. One thing I tend to believe is that one of the reasons the Tea Party has been so successful is that people feel really powerless right now. And so the Tea Party ideology says to folks, yes, you're right, you're powerless, and the reason you're powerless is because of big government. And some Democrats tend to respond saying, no, you're wrong, you're not powerless. But I actually think people are right to feel sort of out of power to in this increasingly stratified class economy. And I think the truth is the reason they're out of power isn't government. It's actually the big companies, and the big companies that are taking on a quasi-feudal role in our economy. So I think the response to the Tea Party has to be not they're lying, you're out of power, but no, you're right, you're out of power. You're just out of power for a very different reason. It's because of this concentration of private power. So I think if people don't feel like politicians are telling them the truth, it's hard for them to get out and engage with them. Even if they know tactically, I'll tell you from campaigning for Senate Democrats in New York State, you can talk to people who will sort of know theoretically, tactically, oh, yes, I should go vote for that person. But if they don't believe they're telling them the truth in some way about the world that they experience, it's hard to actually get them to go.
So it sounds like you have amassed a pretty deep reservoir of knowledge now about running for office, what works and what doesn't work. So what's your next political move?
Well, I don't know what exactly, but I will tell you the one thing. Now, I have been studying politics. I've worked in politics. I love politics. But the one thing that nobody told me is how extraordinarily, what a privilege it is to actually run for office. You can ask anybody any question, and they'll, you know, what's wrong with your life? How do you think we should fix this? What do you think of the tax code? And you'd be amazed at the intelligence and creativity that people have. And, you know, just on a personal level, to be able to walk into so many doors, to be invited into so many different churches, to talk to different business owners was actually really extraordinary. So I would love to run for office again. I would certainly love to serve. I don't have any particular plans. I'm deeply involved in New York politics, though. So what that means is there's a chance that New York would go forward with hydrofracking, and I'll be working actively with a fractivist in New York State to stop that, and then also with the teachers and parents to sort of stop the wave of privatization.
New York has never had a female governor, if I'm correct.
I know. It would have been great.
So what did you find, or what do you feel are the, you know, being a woman statewide candidate, how did you make that one of your strengths in running for office?
Well, it's deeper than governor. New York has an overwhelmingly male sort of power structure in Albany. It's the disconnect between New York's extraordinary private culture and its, you know, the culture of the state and what happens in Albany is really pretty severe. But I will say that I found the press in New York to be, I expected far worse. I expected it to be very hard to run as a woman in New York. I tended to address it pretty directly. I would talk to reporters off the record and say, you know, just so you know, I've looked at how women get covered in races, and if you talk about appearance or talk about these kinds of issues, it tends to deflect from the core issues. So, it's up to you, but here's some studies if you want to read them and just address it directly. But I actually, I think that there is a lot of excitement about the possibility of a female governor in New York State. In part because it is such an old boys network that runs the state. But I, my experience on the whole is pretty positive, and I'd really encourage a lot more women to run for office.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Zephyr Teachout, thanks for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Well, it's wonderful to be on, and I'm sorry that the phone wasn't working out earlier, but really great to talk to you and talk to your listeners.
Okay, great. Zephyr Teachout is a professor at Fordham Law School and ran against Governor Andrew Cuomo for governor of New York. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 here on WDEV.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and their some 750 members, along with additional support from National Life Insurance for over 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, Fairpoint. Small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By The Alchemist, serving Greater Waterbury since 2003. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And Green Mountain Power, all partnering with customers to promote clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. Join us next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Vermont Conversations with David Goodman.
World War II. Party Chairman Ryan Spree.